The judicious mix of these two modes of thought is central to the success of science. Good scientists do both. On their own, talking to themselves, they churn up many new ideas and criticize them systematically. Most of the ideas never make it to the outside world. Only those that pass a rigorous self-filtration make it out to be criticized by the rest of the scientific community. Because of this dogged mutual and self-criticism, and the proper reliance on experiment as the arbiter between contending hypotheses, many scientists tend to be diffident about describing their own sense of wonder at the dawning of a wild surmise. This is a pity, because these rare, exultant moments demystify and humanize the scientific endeavor. Responsible, thoroughgoing, rigorous skepticism requires a hard-nosed habit of thought that takes practice and training to master. Credulity, I think a better word here is openness or wonder, does not come easily either. If we really are to be open to counterintuitive ideas in physics or social organization or anything else, we must grasp those ideas. It means nothing to be open to a proposition we don't understand. Both skepticism and wonder are skills that need honing and practice. Their harmonious marriage within the mind of every schoolchild ought to be a principal goal of public education. I'd love to see such a domestic felicity portrayed in the media, television especially. A community of people really working the mix, full of wonder, generously open to every notion, dismissing nothing except for good reason, but at the same time, and as second nature, demanding stringent standards of evidence. And these standards applied with at least as much rigor to what they hold so dear as to what they are tempted to reject with impunity. Every now and then, I'm lucky enough to teach a kindergarten or first grade class. Many of these children are natural-born scientists, although heavy on the wonder side and light on skepticism. They're curious, intellectually vigorous. Provocative and insightful questions bubble out of them. They exhibit enormous enthusiasm. I'm asked follow-up questions. They've never heard of the notion of a dumb question. But when I talk to high school seniors, I find something different. They memorize facts. By and large, though, the joy of discovery, the life behind those facts, has gone out of them. They've lost much of the wonder and gained very little skepticism. They're worried about asking dumb questions. They're willing to accept inadequate answers. They don't pose follow-up questions. The room is awash with sidelong glances to judge, second by second, the approval of their peers. They come to class with their questions written out on pieces of paper, which they surreptitiously examine, waiting their turn and oblivious of whatever discussion their peers are at this moment engaged in. Something has happened between first and twelfth grade, and it's not just puberty. I'd guess that it's partly peer pressure not to excel, except in sports. Partly that the society teaches short-term gratification. Partly the impression that science or mathematics won't buy you a sports car. Partly that so little is expected of students. And partly that there are few rewards or role models for intelligent discussion of science and technology, or even for learning for its own sake. Those few who remain interested are vilified as nerds or geeks or grinds. But there's something else. I find many adults are put off when young children pose scientific questions. Why is the moon round? The children ask. Why is grass green? What is a dream? How deep can you dig a hole? When is the world's birthday? Why do we have toes? Too many teachers and parents answer with irritation or ridicule, or quickly move on to something else. What did you expect the moon to be? Square? Children soon recognize that somehow this kind of question annoys the grown-ups. A few more experiences like it, and another child has been lost to science. Why adults should pretend to omniscience before six-year-olds, I can't for the life of me understand. What's wrong with admitting that we don't know something? Is our self-esteem so fragile? What's more, many of these questions go to deep issues in science, a few of which are not yet fully resolved. Why the moon is round has to do with the fact that gravity is a central force pulling towards the middle of any world, and with how strong rocks are. Grass is green because of the pigment chlorophyll, of course. We've all had that drummed into us by high school. But why do plants have chlorophyll? It seems foolish, since the sun puts out its peak energy in the yellow and green part of the spectrum. Why should plants all over the world reject sunlight in its most abundant wavelengths? Maybe it's a frozen accident from the ancient history of life on Earth. but there's something we still don't understand about why grass is green. There are many better responses than making the child feel that asking deep questions constitutes a social blunder. If we have an idea of the answer, we can try to explain. Even an incomplete attempt constitutes a reassurance and encouragement. If we have no idea of the answer, we can go to the encyclopedia. If we don't have an encyclopedia, we can take the child to the library. Or we might say, I don't know the answer. Maybe no one knows. Maybe when you grow up, you will be the first person to find out. There are naive questions, tedious questions, ill-phrased questions, questions put after inadequate self-criticism. But every question is a cry to understand the world. There is no such thing as a dumb question. Bright, curious children are a national and world resource. They need to be cared for, cherished, and encouraged. But mere encouragement isn't enough. We must also give them the essential tools to think with. It's official, reads one newspaper headline. We stink in science. In tests of average 17-year-olds in many world regions, the U.S. ranked dead last in algebra. On identical tests, the U.S. kids averaged 43% and their Japanese counterparts 78%. In my book, 78% is pretty good. It corresponds to a C+, or maybe even a B-. 43% is an F. In a chemistry test, students in only 2 of 13 nations did worse than the U.S. Britain, Singapore, and Hong Kong were so high they were almost off scale, and 25% of Canadian 18-year-olds knew just as much chemistry as a select 1% of American high school seniors in their second chemistry course, and most of them in advanced placement programs. The best of 20 fifth-grade classrooms in Minneapolis was outpaced by every one of 20 classrooms in Sendai, Japan, and 19 out of 20 in Taipei, Taiwan. South Korean students were far ahead of American students in all aspects of mathematics and science, and 13-year-olds in British Columbia, in Western Canada, outpaced their U.S. counterparts across the board. In some areas, they did better than the Koreans. Of the U.S. kids, 22% say they dislike school. Only 8% of the Koreans do. Yet two-thirds of the Americans, but only a quarter of the Koreans, say they are good at mathematics. 63% of American adults are unaware that the last dinosaur died before the first human arose. 75% do not know that antibiotics kill bacteria, but not viruses. 57% do not know that electrons are smaller than atoms. Polls show that something like half of American adults do not know that the Earth goes around the sun and takes a year to do it. I can find in my undergraduate classes at Cornell University bright students who do not know that the stars rise and set at night, or even that the sun is a star. Because of science fiction, the educational system, NASA, and the role that science plays in society, Americans have much more exposure to the Copernican insight than does the average human. A 1993 poll by the China Association of Science and Technology shows that, as in America, no more than half the people in China know that the Earth revolves around the sun once a year. It may very well be, then, that more than 4.5 centuries after Copernicus, most people on Earth still think in their heart of hearts that our planet sits immobile at the center of the universe and that we are profoundly special. These are typical questions in scientific literacy. The results are appalling. But what do they measure? The memorization of authoritative pronouncements. What they should be asking is how we know that antibiotics discriminate between microbes, that electrons are smaller than atoms, that the sun is a star which the Earth orbits once a year. Such questions are a much truer measure of public understanding of science, and the results of such tests would doubtless be more disheartening still. If you accept the literal truth of every word of the Bible, then the Earth must be flat. The same is true for the Quran. Pronouncing the Earth round then means you're an atheist. In 1993, the supreme religious authority of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdel Aziz ibn Baz, issued an edict, or fatwa, declaring that the world is flat. Anyone of the round persuasion does not believe in God and should be punished. I meet many people offended by evolution, who passionately prefer to be the personal handicraft of God than to arise by blind physical and chemical forces over eons from slime. They also tend to be less than assiduous in exposing themselves to the evidence. Evidence has little to do with it. What they wish to be true, they believe is true. Only 9% of Americans accept the central finding of modern biology that human beings, and all the other species, have slowly evolved by natural processes from a succession of more ancient beings with no divine intervention needed along the way. When asked merely if they accept evolution, 45% of Americans say yes. The figure is 70% in China. When the movie Jurassic Park was shown in Israel, it was condemned by some Orthodox rabbis because it accepted evolution and because it taught that dinosaurs lived 100 million years ago, when, as is plainly stated at every Rosh Hashanah and every Jewish wedding ceremony, the universe is less than 6,000 years old. The clearest evidence of our evolution can be found in our genes. But evolution is still being fought, ironically, by those whose own DNA proclaims it, in the schools, in the courts, in textbook publishing houses, and on the question of just how much pain we can inflict on other animals without crossing some ethical threshold. During the Great Depression, teachers enjoyed job security, good salaries, respectability. Teaching was an admired profession, partly because learning was widely recognized as the road out of poverty. Little of that is true today. And so science, and other teaching, is too often incompetently or uninspiringly done, its practitioners, astonishingly, having little or no training in their subjects, impatient with the method and in a hurry to get to the findings of science, and sometimes themselves unable to distinguish science from pseudoscience. Those who do have the training often get higher-paying jobs elsewhere. Children need hands-on experience with the experimental method rather than just reading about science in a book. Experiment and the scientific method can be taught in many matters other than science. Daniel Kunitz is a friend of mine from college. He spent his life as an innovative junior and senior high school social sciences teacher. Want the students to understand the Constitution of the United States? You could have them read it, article by article, and then discuss it in class. But sadly, this will put most of them to sleep. Or you could try the Kunitz method. You forbid the students to read the Constitution. Instead, you assign them, two for each state, to attend a constitutional convention. You brief each of the 13 teams in detail on the particular interests of their state and region. The South Carolina delegation, say, would be told of the primacy of cotton, the necessity and morality of the slave trade, the danger posed by the industrial North, and so on. The 13 delegations assemble, and with a little faculty guidance, but mainly on their own, over some weeks write a constitution. Then they read the real constitution. The students have reserved war-making powers to the president. The delegates of 1787 assigned them to Congress. Why? The students have freed the slaves. The original constitutional convention did not. Why? This takes more preparation by the teachers and more work by the students, but the experience is unforgettable. It's hard not to think that the nations of the earth would be in better shape if every citizen went through a comparable experience. American schoolchildren don't do enough schoolwork. There are 180 days in the standard school year in the United States, as compared with 220 in South Korea, about 230 in Germany, and 243 in Japan. Children in some of these countries go to school on Saturday. The average American high school student spends 3.5 hours a week on homework. The total time devoted to studies in and out of the classroom is about 20 hours a week. Japanese fifth graders average 33 hours a week. Japan, with half the population of the United States, produces twice as many scientists and engineers with advanced degrees every year. Those in America with the most favorable view of science tend to be young, well-to-do, college-educated white males. But three-quarters of new American workers in the next decade will be women, non-whites, and immigrants. Failing to rouse their enthusiasm, to say nothing of discriminating against them, isn't only unjust, it's also stupid and self-defeating. It deprives the economy of desperately needed skilled workers. African-American and Hispanic students are doing significantly better in standardized science tests now than in the late 1960s, but they're the only ones who are. The average math gap between white and black U.S. high school graduates is still huge, 2 to 3 grade levels. But the gap between white U.S. high school graduates and those in, say, Japan, Canada, Great Britain, or Finland is more than twice as large, with the U.S. students behind. If you're poorly motivated and poorly educated, you won't know much. No mystery there. Suburban African Americans with college-educated parents do just as well in college as suburban whites with college-educated parents. According to some statistics, enrolling a poor child in a Head Start program doubles his or her chances to be employed later in life. One who completes an upward bound program is four times as likely to get a college education. If we're serious, we know what to do. Why should it be hard for scientists to get science across? Some scientists, including some very good ones, tell me they'd love to popularize, but feel they lack talent in this area. Knowing and explaining, they say, are not the same thing. What's the secret? There's only one, I think. Don't talk to the general audience as you would to your scientific colleagues. There are terms that convey your meaning instantly and accurately to fellow experts. You may pass these phrases every day in your professional work, but they do no more than mystify an audience of non-specialists. Use the simplest possible language. Above all, remember how it was before you yourself grasped whatever it is you're explaining. Remember the misunderstandings that you almost fell into, and note them explicitly. Keep firmly in mind that there was a time when you didn't understand any of this either. Recapitulate the first steps that led you from ignorance to knowledge. Never forget that native intelligence is widely distributed in our species. Indeed, it is the secret of our success. The effort involved is slight, the benefits great. Among the potential pitfalls are oversimplification, the need to be sparing with qualifications and quantifications, inadequate credit given to the many scientists involved, and insufficient distinctions drawn between helpful analogy and reality. Doubtless, compromises must be made. The more you make such presentations, the clearer it is which approaches work and which do not. There is a natural selection of metaphors, images, analogies, anecdotes. After a while, you find that you can get almost anywhere you want to go, walking on consumer-tested stepping stones. You can then fine-tune your presentations for the needs of a given audience. Like some editors and television producers, some scientists believe the public is too ignorant or too stupid to understand science, that the enterprise of popularization is fundamentally a lost cause, or even that it's tantamount to fraternization, if not outright cohabitation, with the enemy. Among the many criticisms that could be made of this judgment, along with its insufferable arrogance and its neglect of a host of examples of highly successful science popularizations, is that it is self-confirming, and also, for the scientists involved, self-defeating. There is no single solution to the problem of illiteracy in science, or math, history, English, geography, and many of the other skills which our society needs more of. The responsibilities are broadly shared. Parents, the voting public, local school boards, the media, teachers, administrators, federal, state, and local governments, plus, of course, the students themselves. At every level, teachers complain that the problem lies in earlier grades. And first-grade teachers can, with justice, despair of teaching children with learning deficits because of malnutrition, or no books in the home, or a culture of violence in which the leisure to think is unavailable. I know very well from my own experience how much a child can benefit from parents who have a little learning and are able to pass it on. Even small improvements in the education, communication skills, and passion for learning in one generation might work much larger improvements in the next. I think of this every time I hear a complaint that school and collegiate standards are falling, or that a bachelor's degree doesn't mean what it once did. At the same time, children with special abilities and skills need to be nourished and encouraged. They are a national treasure. Challenging programs for the gifted are sometimes decried as elitism. Why aren't intensive practice sessions for varsity football, baseball, and basketball players and inter-school competition deemed elitism? After all, only the most gifted athletes participate. There is a self-defeating double standard at work here, nationwide. In the closing years of the Soviet Union, Anne Drian and I found ourselves at a dinner in Peredelkino, a village outside Moscow, where Communist Party officials, retired generals, and a few favored intellectuals had their summer homes. The air was electric with the prospect of new freedoms, especially the right to speak your mind even if the government doesn't like what you're saying. The fabled revolution of rising expectations was in full flower. But despite glasnost, there were widespread doubts. Would those in power really allow their own critics to be heard? Would freedom of speech, of assembly, of the press, of religion, really be permitted? Would people inexperienced with freedom be able to bear its burdens? Some of the Soviet citizens present at the dinner had fought, for decades and against long odds, for the freedoms that most Americans take for granted. Indeed, they had been inspired by the American experiment, a real-world demonstration that nations, even multicultural and multi-ethnic nations, could survive and prosper with these freedoms reasonably intact. They went so far as to raise the possibility that prosperity was due to freedom, that in an age of high technology and swift change, the two rise or fall together, that the openness of science and democracy, their willingness to be judged by experiment, were closely allied ways of thinking. There were many toasts, as there always are at dinners in that part of the world. The most memorable was given by a world-famous Soviet novelist. He stood up, raised his glass, looked us in the eye, and said, "To the Americans, they have a little freedom." He paused a beat, and then added, "And they know how to keep it." Do we? The ink was barely dry on the Bill of Rights before politicians found a way to subvert it, by cashing in on fear and patriotic hysteria. In 1798, the ruling Federalist Party knew that the button to push was ethnic and cultural prejudice. Exploiting tensions between France and the US, and a widespread fear that the French and Irish immigrants were somehow intrinsically unfit to be Americans, the Federalists passed a set of laws that have come to be known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. One law upped the residency requirement for citizenship from 5 to 14 years. Citizens of French and Irish origin usually voted for the opposition, Thomas Jefferson's Democratic-Republican Party. The Alien Act gave President John Adams the power to deport any foreigner who aroused his suspicions. "Making the president nervous," said a member of Congress, "is the new crime." The Sedition Act made it unlawful to publish false or malicious criticism of the government or to inspire opposition to any of its acts. Some 2 dozen arrests were made, 10 people were convicted, and many more were censored or intimidated into silence. The act attempted, Jefferson said, to crush all political opposition by making criticism of Federalist officials or policies a crime. As soon as Jefferson was elected, indeed in the first week of his presidency in 1801, he began pardoning every victim of the Sedition Act because, he said, it was as contrary to the spirit of American freedoms as if Congress had ordered us all to fall down and worship a golden calf. By 1802, none of the Alien and Sedition Acts remained on the books. From across 2 centuries, it's hard to recapture the frenzied mood that made the French and the wild Irish seem so grave a threat that we were willing to surrender our most precious freedoms. Giving credit for French and Irish cultural triumphs, advocating equal rights for them, was in effect decried in conservative circles as sentimental, unrealistic political correctness. But that's how it always works. It always seems an aberration later. But by then, we're in the grip of the next hysteria. Those who seek power at any price detect a societal weakness, a fear that they can ride into office. It could be ethnic differences, as it was then, perhaps different amounts of melanin in the skin, different philosophies or religions, or maybe it's drug use, violent crime, economic crisis, school prayer, or desecrating, literally making unholy, the flag. Whatever the problem, the quick fix is to shave a little freedom off the Bill of Rights. Yes, in 1942, Japanese Americans were protected by the Bill of Rights, but we locked them up anyway. After all, there was a war on. Yes, there are constitutional prohibitions against unreasonable search and seizure, but we have a war on drugs and violent crime is racing out of control. Yes, there's freedom of speech, but we don't want foreign authors here spouting alien ideologies, do we? The pretexts change from year to year, but the result remains the same. Concentrating more power in fewer hands and suppressing diversity of opinion, even though experience plainly shows the dangers of such a course of action. If we do not know what we're capable of, we cannot appreciate measures taken to protect us from ourselves. It is a fact of life on our beleaguered little planet that widespread torture, famine, and governmental criminal irresponsibility are much more likely to be found in tyrannical than in democratic governments. Why? Because the rulers of the former are much less likely to be thrown out of office for their misdeeds than the rulers of the latter. This is error-correcting machinery in politics. The methods of science, with all its imperfections, can be used to improve social, political, and economic systems, and this is, I think, true no matter what criterion of improvement is adopted. How is this possible if science is based on experiment? Humans are not electrons or laboratory rats. But every act of Congress, every Supreme Court decision, every presidential national security directive, every change in the prime rate is an experiment. Every shift in economic policy, every increase or decrease in funding for Head Start, every toughening of criminal sentences is an experiment. Exchanging needles, making condoms freely available, or decriminalizing marijuana are all experiments. Doing nothing to help Abyssinia against Italy, or to prevent Nazi Germany from invading the Rhineland, was an experiment. Communism in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, and China was an experiment. Privatizing mental health care or prisons is an experiment. Japan and West Germany investing a great deal in science and technology and next to nothing on defense, and finding that their economies boomed, was an experiment. Handguns are available for self-protection in Seattle, but not in nearby Vancouver, Canada. Handgun killings are 5 times more common in Seattle, and the handgun suicide rate is 10 times greater in Seattle. Guns make impulsive killing easy. This is also an experiment. In almost all of these cases, adequate control experiments are not performed, or variables are insufficiently separated. Nevertheless, to a certain and often useful degree, policy ideas can be tested. The great waste would be to ignore the results of social experiments because they seem to be ideologically unpalatable. There is no nation on earth today optimized for the middle of the 21st century. We face an abundance of subtle and complex problems. We need, therefore, subtle and complex solutions. Since there is no deductive theory of social organization, our only recourse is scientific experiment, trying out sometimes on small scales, community, city, and state level, say, a wide range of alternatives. One of the perquisites of power on becoming prime minister in China in the 5th century BC was that you got to construct a model state in your home district or province. It was Confucius' chief life failing, he lamented, that he never got to try. Even a casual scrutiny of history reveals that we humans have a sad tendency to make the same mistakes again and again. We're afraid of strangers or anybody who's a little different from us. When we get scared, we start pushing people around. We have readily accessible buttons that release powerful emotions when pressed. We can be manipulated into utter senselessness by clever politicians. Give us the right kind of leader, and, like the most suggestible subjects of the hypnotherapists, we'll gladly do just about anything he wants, even things we know to be wrong. The framers of the Constitution were students of history. In recognition of the human condition, they sought to invent a means that would keep us free in spite of ourselves. Some of the opponents of the U.S. Constitution insisted that it would never work, that a republican form of government spanning a land with such dissimilar climates, economies, morals, politics, and peoples, as Governor George Clinton of New York said, was impossible, that such a government and such a constitution, as Patrick Henry of Virginia declared, contradicts all the experience of the world. The experiment was tried anyway. Scientific findings and attitudes were common in those who invented the United States. The supreme authority, outranking any personal opinion, any book, any revelation, was, as the Declaration of Independence puts it, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Dr. Benjamin Franklin was revered in Europe and America as the founder of the new field of electrical physics. At the Constitutional Convention of 1789, John Adams repeatedly appealed to the analogy of mechanical balance in machines. Others, to William Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood. Late in life, Adams wrote, "All mankind are chemists from their cradles to their graves. The material universe is a chemical experiment." James Madison used chemical and biological metaphors in the Federalist Papers. The American revolutionaries were creatures of the European Enlightenment, which provides an essential background for understanding the origins and purpose of the United States. Science and its philosophical corollaries, wrote the American historian Clinton Rossiter, were perhaps the most important intellectual force shaping the destiny of 18th century America. Franklin was only one of a number of forward-looking colonists who recognized the kinship of scientific method and democratic procedure. Free inquiry, free exchange of information, optimism, self-criticism, pragmatism, objectivity, all these ingredients of the coming republic were already active in the republic of science that flourished in the 18th century. Thomas Jefferson was a scientist. That's how he described himself. When you visit his home at Monticello, Virginia, the moment you enter its portals, you find ample evidence of his scientific interests. Not just in his immense and varied library, but in copying machines, automatic doors, telescopes and other instruments, some at the cutting edge of early 19th century technology. Some he invented, some he copied, some he purchased. He compared the plants and animals of America with Europe's, uncovered fossils, used the calculus in the design of a new plough. He mastered Newtonian physics. Nature destined him, he said, to be a scientist, but there were no opportunities for scientists in pre-revolutionary Virginia. Other, more urgent needs took precedence. He threw himself into the historic events that were transpiring around him. Once independence was won, he said, later generations could devote themselves to science and scholarship. Jefferson was an early hero of mine, not because of his scientific interests, although they very much helped to mold his political philosophy, but because he, almost more than anyone else, was responsible for the spread of democracy throughout the world. The idea, breathtaking, radical, and revolutionary at the time, in many places in the world it still is that not kings, not priests, not big city bosses, not dictators, not a military cabal, not a de facto conspiracy of the wealthy, but ordinary people working together are to rule the nations. Not only was Jefferson a leading theoretician of this cause, he was also involved in the most practical way, helping to bring about the great American political experiment that has, all over the world, been admired and emulated since. He died at Monticello on July 4, 1826, 50 years to the day after the colonies issued that stirring document written by Jefferson called the Declaration of Independence. It was denounced by conservatives worldwide. Monarchy, aristocracy, and state-supported religion, that's what conservatives were defending then. In a letter composed a few days before his death, he wrote that it was the light of science that had demonstrated that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor were a favored few born booted and spurred. He had written in the Declaration of Independence that we all must have the same opportunities, the same unalienable rights. And if the definition of all was disgracefully incomplete in 1776, the spirit of the Declaration was generous enough that today all is far more inclusive. Jefferson was a student of history, not just the compliant and safe history that praises our own time or country or ethnic group, but the real history of real humans, our weaknesses as well as our strengths. History taught him that the rich and powerful will steal and oppress if given half a chance. He described the governments of Europe, which he saw at first hand as the American ambassador to France. Under the pretense of government, he said, they had divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. Jefferson taught that every government degenerates when it is left to the rulers alone, because rulers, by the very act of ruling, misuse the public trust. The people themselves, he said, are the only prudent repository of power. But he worried that the people, and the argument goes back to Thucydides and Aristotle, are easily misled. So he advocated safeguards, insurance policies. One was the constitutional separation of powers. Accordingly, various groups, some pursuing their own selfish interests, balance one another, preventing any one of them from running away with the country. The executive, legislative, and judicial branches, the House and the Senate, the states and the federal government. He also stressed, passionately and repeatedly, that it was essential for the people to understand the risks and benefits of government, to educate themselves and to involve themselves in the political process. Without that, he said, the wolves will take over. Here's how he put it in Notes on Virginia, stressing how the powerful and unscrupulous find zones of vulnerability they can exploit. In every government on earth is some trace of human weakness, some germ of corruption and degeneracy, which cunning will discover and wickedness insensibly open, cultivate, and improve. Every government degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories, and to render even them safe, their minds must be improved. Jefferson had little to do with the actual writing of the U.S. Constitution. As it was being formulated, he was serving as American minister to France. When he read its provisions, he was pleased, but with two reservations. One deficiency: no limit was provided on the number of terms the president could serve. This, Jefferson feared, was a way for a president to become a king, in fact, if not in law. The other major deficiency was the absence of a Bill of Rights. The citizen, the average person, was insufficiently protected, Jefferson thought, from the inevitable abuses of those in power. He advocated freedom of speech, in part so that even wildly unpopular views could be expressed, so that deviations from the conventional wisdom could be offered for consideration. Personally, he was an extremely amiable man, reluctant to criticise even his sworn enemies. He displayed a bust of his arch-adversary Alexander Hamilton in the vestibule at Monticello. Nevertheless, he believed that the habit of scepticism is an essential prerequisite for responsible citizenship. He argued that the cost of education is trivial compared to the cost of ignorance, of leaving the government to the wolves. He taught that the country is safe only when the people rule. Part of the duty of citizenship is not to be intimidated into conformity. I wish that the oath of citizenship taken by recent immigrants and the pledge that students routinely recite included something like, "I promise to question everything my leaders tell me." That would be really to Thomas Jefferson's point. "I promise to use my critical faculties. I promise to develop my independence of thought. I promise to educate myself so I can make my own judgments." I also wish that the Pledge of Allegiance were directed at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, as it is when the President takes his oath of office, rather than to the flag and the nation. When we consider the founders of our nation, Jefferson, Washington, Samuel and John Adams, Madison and Monroe, Benjamin Franklin, Tom Paine and many others, we have before us a list of at least 10 and maybe even dozens of great political leaders. They were well educated, products of the European Enlightenment, they were students of history. They knew human fallibility and weakness and corruptibility. They were fluent in the English language. They wrote their own speeches. They were realistic and practical, and at the same time motivated by high principles. They were not checking the pollsters on what to think this week. They knew what to think. They were comfortable with long-term thinking, planning even further ahead than the next election. They were self-sufficient, not requiring careers as politicians or lobbyists to make a living. They were able to bring out the best in us. They were interested in, and at least two of them, fluent in science. They attempted to set a course for the United States into the far future, not so much by establishing laws as by setting limits on what kinds of laws could be passed. The Constitution and its Bill of Rights have done remarkably well, constituting, despite human weaknesses, a machine able, more often than not, to correct its own trajectory. At that time, there were only about 2.5 million citizens of the United States. Today, there are about 100 times more. So if there were 10 people of the caliber of Thomas Jefferson then, there ought to be 10 times 100 equals 1,000 Thomas Jeffersons today. Where are they? In his celebrated little book On Liberty, the English philosopher John Stuart Mill argued that silencing an opinion is a peculiar evil. If the opinion is right, we are robbed of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth, and if it's wrong, we are deprived of a deeper understanding of the truth in its collision with error. If we know only our side of the argument, we hardly know even that. It becomes stale, soon learned only by rote, untested, a pallid and lifeless truth. Mill also wrote, "If society lets any considerable number of its members grow up as mere children, incapable of being acted on by rational consideration of distant motives, society has itself to blame." Jefferson made the point even more strongly. If a nation expects to be both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. In a letter to Madison, he continued the thought, "A society that will trade a little liberty for a little order will lose both and deserve neither." New ideas, invention and creativity in general, always spearhead a kind of freedom, a breaking out from hobbling constraints. Freedom is a prerequisite for continuing the delicate experiment of science, which is one reason the Soviet Union could not remain a totalitarian state and be technologically competitive. At the same time, science, or rather its delicate mix of openness and skepticism and its encouragement of diversity and debate, is a prerequisite for continuing the delicate experiment of freedom in an industrial and highly technological society. Once you question the religious insistence on the prevailing view that the Earth was at the center of the universe, why should you accept the repeated and confident assertions by religious leaders that God sent kings to rule over us? In the 17th century, it was easy to whip English and colonial juries into a frenzy over this impiety or that heresy. They were willing to torture people to death for their beliefs. By the late 18th century, they weren't so sure. Rossiter again, from Seed Time of the Republic, 1953. Under the pressure of the American environment, Christianity grew more humanistic and temperate, more tolerant with the struggle of the sects, more liberal with the growth of optimism and rationalism, more experimental with the rise of science, more individualistic with the advent of democracy. Equally important, increasing numbers of colonists, as a legion of preachers loudly lamented, were turning secular in curiosity and skeptical in attitude. The Bill of Rights decoupled religion from the state, in part because so many religions were steeped in an absolutist frame of mind, each convinced that it alone had a monopoly on the truth, and therefore eager for the state to impose this truth on others. Often, the leaders and practitioners of absolutist religions were unable to perceive any middle ground or recognize that the truth might draw upon and embrace apparently contradictory doctrines. The framers of the Bill of Rights had before them the example of England, where the ecclesiastical crime of heresy and the secular crime of treason had become nearly indistinguishable. Many of the early colonists had come to America fleeing religious persecution, although some of them were perfectly happy to persecute other people for their beliefs. The founders of our nation recognized that a close relation between the government and any of the quarrelsome religions would be fatal to freedom and injurious to religion. Rossiter concludes, "The twin doctrines of separation of church and state and liberty of individual conscience are the marrow of our democracy, if not indeed America's most magnificent contribution to the freeing of Western man." Now, it's no good to have such rights if they're not used. A right of free speech when no one contradicts the government, freedom of the press when no one is willing to ask the tough questions, a right of assembly when there are no protests, universal suffrage when less than half the electorate votes, separation of church and state when the wall of separation is not regularly repaired. Through disuse, they can become no more than votive objects, patriotic lip service. Rights and freedoms, use 'em or lose 'em. Due to the foresight of the framers of the Bill of Rights, and even more so to all those who at considerable personal risk insisted on exercising those rights, it's hard now to bottle up free speech. School library committees, the Immigration Service, the police, the FBI, or the ambitious politician looking to score cheap votes may attempt it from time to time, but sooner or later the cork pops. The Constitution is, after all, the law of the land. Public officials are sworn to uphold it, and activists and the courts episodically hold their feet to the fire. However, through lowered educational standards, declining intellectual competence, diminished zest for substantive debate, and social sanctions against skepticism, our liberties can be slowly eroded and our rights subverted. The founders understood this well. The time for fixing every essential right on a legal basis is while our rulers are honest and ourselves united, said Thomas Jefferson. From the conclusion of this revolutionary war, we shall be going downhill. It will not then be necessary to resort every moment to the people for support. They will be forgotten, therefore, and their rights disregarded. They will forget themselves, but in the sole faculty of making money, and will never think of uniting to effect a due respect for their rights. The shackles, therefore, which shall not be knocked off at the conclusion of this war, will remain on us long, will be made heavier and heavier, till our rights shall revive or expire in a convulsion. Education on the value of free speech and the other freedoms reserved by the Bill of Rights, about what happens when you don't have them, and about how to exercise and protect them, should be an essential prerequisite for being an American citizen, or indeed a citizen of any nation, the more so to the degree that such rights remain unprotected. If we can't think for ourselves, if we're unwilling to question authority, then we're just putty in the hands of those in power. But if the citizens are educated and form their own opinions, then those in power work for us. In every country, we should be teaching our children the scientific method and the reasons for a Bill of Rights. With it comes a certain decency, humility, and community spirit. In the demon-haunted world that we inhabit by virtue of being human, this may be all that stands between us and the enveloping darkness.